Let's turn to Genesis chapter 19, and we will pick up where we left off last week. And in Genesis chapter 18, we saw this, the latter end of the chapter, we saw this beautiful example and model and illustration, whatever word we want to use, for intercession as it came forth out of Abraham's life. A man who was very well aware of the wickedness of Sodom, very well aware of the depths of sin that was going on there, a man who lived a life of holiness and separation and thus a life of peace, while all of the nightmare of a life that Lot was living was going on. And yet he begins to cry out to God and begins to intercede for the city, and he brings him down from, if there be 50 righteous there, would he spare the city for 50? And intercedes all the way down to 10, and God says, if there are 10 righteous there, I will spare the city for the sake of 10 righteous. And in this intercession that Abraham makes, as he is speaking to God, he's not really using prayer as a means to get God in a headlock and force him into something that God didn't want to do. God was very desirous of saving the city, but he knew that there weren't going to be even 10 righteous in that city. But it is so important, this thing called intercession. And it's very important to us, even beyond the impact that our intercession, our prayer for others and situations that are beyond us, even beyond the impact that our intercession has related to situations, is the impact that intercession has upon ourselves. And someone has said that prayer changes things, and that's the truth. But the first thing that prayer inevitably changes is us. And one of the interesting observations about intercession, when we begin to intercede against those who despitefully use us or persecute us or persecute us for righteousness' sake, or while somebody is slandering and we're waiting for God to bring forth our righteousness, apparent as the noonday sun, or whatever it might be, and we begin to intercede for that person, isn't it interesting how God begins to change our very heart? He begins to soften it. In the course of 2 minutes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, all of a sudden we're seeing this whole situation 100 miles bigger than we saw it prior to entering into prayer. And so intercession is so important. Not only its impact upon the situation, but also its impact upon our heart in keeping our hearts tender and where they need to be. Someone said concerning D.L. Moody at the time of his ministry, they said, D.L. Moody is the only preacher that I know that ought to teach on hell. Because, they said, because you can hear the tears in his voice. And that comes from intercession. And that's the way that he was. And that's one of the reasons he was a great evangelist, is because his heart was apparent to those who he was attempting to reach. And God used him mightily in that way. And so we come now, in that context, now to chapter 19 of the book of Genesis. Now the two angels came to Sodom in the evening. They've left now the Lord with Abraham, and they've moved on now, and they've gone into Sodom in the evening. And Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom, and that is really the end of the progression. He began by looking towards Sodom, and then pitching his tent towards Sodom. Then we find him dwelling in Sodom, and now he's sitting in the gates of Sodom. And the only men who sat in the gates of Sodom were the chief men. They were the rulers of the city. And so here he has a man that has gained a place of some influence in the city. And one of the interesting things that we'll find out very, very quickly as this chapter unfolds is that God does not compromise. He never compromises His word. He never compromises His nature. He never compromises. And just as surely as God never compromises, the world does not compromise. Sodom does not compromise. The world simply won't do it. It will give the illusion of compromising. And the problem is that many times, and you've heard me say it before, but many times a Christian, like a Lot, His roots are so deep in Sodom, his investment is so deep in Sodom, that he feels compelled now to somehow reconcile God with Sodom and Sodom with God. And he thinks that somehow he's done it. He's been able to move into the city. He's been able to find some common ground between the two of them. You know, these two are able to, you know, kiss in the person of his life. And he's reconciled them somehow. And so he lives in this self-deception that he's been able to do that. And he's going to discover very quickly that God does not compromise and the world doesn't either, and what he has been living is an illusion. So here he is in his position, sitting in the gate of Sodom. And when Lot saw them, he rose to meet them, and he bowed himself with his face toward the ground. And he said, "Hear now, my lords, please turn in to your servant's house and spend the night and wash your feet. Then you may rise early and go on your way." He's extending hospitality to them. And then they said to him, "No, but we will spend the night in the open square." And he knew enough about Sodom that that would not be safe for them. He knew where he was at. And he insisted strongly. And so they turned into him and entered his house. And then he made them a feast and baked unleavened bread, and they ate. And so, you know, tremendous hospitality on his part. Now, before they lay down to sleep for the night, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, both old and young, all the people from every quarter surrounded the house. And they called to Lot and said to him, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may know them carnally," or know them physically, that we might have sexual relations with them. The angels, as we see in almost everywhere that they appear in Scripture, tend to be highly attractive beings. They were noticed immediately by the depraved in the city of Sodom. And they see new people come in, and their lust is stirred up in their heart and the hearts of these men, and now they want to rape these two men that have come into Sodom. And so they come to the house and demand that they would cast them out of the house, that they might be able to do that. And they make no bones about it. They're very, very clear. And so Lot went out to them through the doorway, and he shut the door behind him. And he said, "Please, my brethren," imagine that, "my brethren," he said, "do not do so wickedly." And it gets worse. You think he says, "Oh, my brethren," it gets worse now. "See now, I have two daughters who've not known a man. Please let me bring them out to you, and you may do to them as you wish. Only do nothing to these men, since this is the reason they've come under the shadow of my roof." They've come to be protected. And Lot is the type of man, and it'll develop even more fully as time goes on in this chapter. He's the type of man that involves himself with Sodom, with the world, with sin, with the ways of the world. And not only he doesn't involve himself in the actual acts of that kind, but he comes around and he hangs around the periphery and he just profits from it. He just, you know, makes a living off of it. Just kind of makes a living off of the sin. Makes a living off what the city stands for and this kind of thing. And he's the kind of guy that comes along and says, "Listen, I can live in a Sodom and it doesn't affect me at all." The interesting thing is that for the Lot, is he really is in the gravest self-deception here, because he thinks that the city hasn't affected him, and he is willing to turn his daughters over to them for the evening, the entire city. It's amazing how far he's fallen. Amazing how far he is falling. "It doesn't affect me, seeing you." I mean, you see people say that all the time. "Well, you know, I can watch anything on TV. I can listen to anything, and it really doesn't affect me." And then you turn around and you see some ghastly thing that they do without any conviction at all in their heart, and they have no sense to put one plus one together and realize that that comes out of this. The interesting thing to remember here is that Lot put himself in Sodom. It is one thing for God to raise a man or a woman up and put them in a city and call them and equip them for the uniqueness of the ministry that would be required in Sodom. But he is not there out of obedience unto God. He is there because he has chosen to be, because it looked like the easiest way to make money. And so here he is, he offers his virgin daughters to this crowd, and then they say to him, "Stand back." And then they said, "This one came in to sojourn, and he keeps acting as a judge. Now we'll deal worse with you than with them," with these angels. They're just about to take him and ravage him sexually. And so they pressed hard against the man Lot and came near to break down the door, but the men reached out their hands and pulled Lot into the house with them and shut the door, and they struck the men who were at the doorway of the house with blindness, both small and great, so that they became weary trying to find the door. And so in effect, these angels make them outwardly what they were morally and intellectually. Blind, and he blinds them there on the doorstep. The interesting thing is this, is that we will never reach the world by being like the world. We can try it like untold millions of Christians have tried before us. But it is holiness, they notice, not false definitions of holiness as it relates to some this or that or whatever man-made definition, but a genuine holiness, a difference in my life, a Christ-likeness in my life. It is that that impacts people, not becoming like them in their sin. And when you are different from people, there will be persecution. Someone has said that if you live a life that is lower than the standard of the world, they'll prosecute you. And if you live a life that's higher than the standard of the world, they'll persecute you. So we're either going to be prosecuted or persecuted, one or the other. And we're not to live lower than them, so there's going to be persecution. And here he begins to experience persecution. But he's done everything he can to escape it, even to the point of compromise. I think that it's very important in this day in which we live, where there is such tremendous controversy, especially in the last 10 years as it relates to the sin of homosexuality, to make sure that we understand as Christians, not because of our own intellectual deductions or whatever, or what our feelings are, or what we think about a given issue or a given sin or whatever it might be, but because God's Word is very clear about it. That is that sodomy and homosexuality is sin. It is sin. It's wrong. God tells us that in the book of 1 Corinthians chapter 6, he talks about those who are homosexuals and those who are sodomites. And in the Greek, what it speaks about is it speaks about those in a homosexual relationship who have the upper hand and those who have the lower hand in that relationship in terms of how it works, the replacement of the man and woman relationship. It's all covered by God. And he says that those that make a lifestyle of homosexuality, they live in that sin, it's a manifestation of the fact that they are not indwelt by the Holy Spirit and that they will not inherit the kingdom of God. And so that's what the Bible teaches. And there's an awful lot of funny things trying to be done with the Scripture in order to accommodate homosexuality. But it is sin. Now, to be sure, it is not a sin greater than any other sin. It's very far-reaching, though, in its influence, but it's a sin, but it's not any greater than adultery. It's not any greater than stealing. Sin is sin. It's all bad. It's all wrong. And so here it's important to understand that sodomy or homosexuality is sin. Absolutely wrong. And all of the pressure today now and the legislation that is coming perilously close to the church in terms of hiring practices and all of this kind of thing as it relates to hiring people that are involved in this sin and in other sins without any discrimination related to it. The Bible teaches that it's sin, and teaches that it's sin here, teaches that it's sin in Romans chapter 1, and there's nothing you can do with that chapter to make it say anything different. You have men who are abusing themselves. They've forsaken the use of women, and they are abusing themselves with other men, women doing likewise. It's homosexuality, and it's sin. And it's important that it continue to be called sin. Why? Because God calls it sin. And He wants to save people from their sin. Doesn't save them from their sickness. Doesn't save them from their predisposition. He saves them from sin. And the great tendency today, the enormous debate that goes on concerning homosexuality, is it environmentally caused or is it biological? Is it hereditary? Is a person born a homosexual, or in the course of abuse as they're growing up and exposure to things, do they become a predisposition towards that, towards homosexuality? And so the battle rages back and forth. The experts on one side, the experts on the other side. And I don't know that they're going to solve that in our lifetime. All I know is that God comes in and says, as far as He's concerned, for the person who is a homosexual, He comes in and He says, it really doesn't matter for you whether it's hereditary or whether it's environmentally caused. I am greater than hereditary factors, and I am greater than environment, and I will save you from your sin. I'll save you from it. And that's what He desires to do, is He desires to save people. He desires to come in and forgive them of their sins and give them a power, the power to live a life on a higher level than the level of sin, whatever it might be. And so oftentimes, the Christian, and they would tag me as fundamentalist and whatever. I wear any badge they want to put on me, except heretic or whatever, but I think it's so wrong for people to take and water something down and then cause people to look to God to do less than He's willing to do in an individual life. And so sin, this is sin, and it's wrong. The interesting thing about the sin of homosexuality, though, and there are a couple of unique characteristics related to it. One of the things it is difficult to deal with is the gay agenda today, as it's called. And oftentimes, in fact, I was watching television just the other night, and you know how continually there are efforts made to clean up television and to get more the violence off of TV and the amount of sexuality that's on TV and all this. I think the average kid will witness something like 33,000 murders in the course of their childhood until the age of 18 and the average doses of television. And so you'll hear the people crying out for, a better handling of, a more responsible handling of television. And inevitably, those who don't want anything like that, and they call it censorship, they say, well, you can control that yourself by simply turning off the dial. That is nonsense. That is a stupid thing to say. And the reason that it's stupid is this, is I can turn off my television, and the kid down the street cannot turn off his television, and he'll watch it, and he'll still drive by and shoot people in my front yard. We don't live in a vacuum. We live in a society. And what affects the society as a whole is going to affect me as a member of the society. It's that simplistic to say, turn off the television. And to think that somehow because I turn off the television and the acts of violence and the immorality on it, that somehow because the rest of the world doesn't, that it's going to stay away from me. No, it influences all of the society. And it's the same thing with the homosexual agenda. You look and you say, well, that's sin. I say, well, they're looking for certain rights and these different kinds of things and all. But the fact of the matter is that there is a desire for this to be accepted as a normal, regular kind of thing. And the problem with that is this. And by the way, I am the chiefest of sinners. This would be my first argument with the Apostle Paul. But concerning this particular sin, God speaks in Romans and he says concerning this thing, he says, and God gave them up, and God gave them up, and God gave them over. And in Romans chapter 1, you have two characteristics given of a particular society that God gives over. Number one, they do not acknowledge the existence of God. They will worship anything. Four-legged creatures, lizards, snakes, cows, cars. They will worship anything on four peds. They'll worship anything, but they will not worship the true and the living God. He said that's the first characteristic. And then when you have a society that lives under that kind of a worldview, and then you couple it, it gets coupled with them accepting the sin of homosexuality as a normal thing, as a natural thing, and not as sin. God says that is a society that is very much in danger of being given up by God. Why? Because once a society is no longer morally or intellectually fair enough to look at the act, given the physiological specifics of the man and the woman, and they're no longer willing to look and say, that is not natural. That is not normal. That is not intended. Then you have a society that will be able to convince itself that anything is right. And it's ripe for judgment. And I don't need to spend one more minute applying it to the United States of America or the world. It's great, great danger. And you look in the world, the history of mankind, and you look in any of the great civilizations of mankind, and what's once the sin of homosexuality was either rampant within the leadership of that particular world-ruling empire, or it was characterized as perfectly okay in that world-ruling empire, it was one of the signs always for that particular empire that it was on its last legs, one of the final characteristics before the collapse of it. All through history, one of the marks. Now again, I want to be very clear that concerning homosexuality, anyone can turn. You have people who are born with a predisposition to set forest fires on fire. Set forest fires. You have people with a predisposition to hurt people. You have people born with a predisposition to lie. You have people who are born with predisposition towards sexual immorality. They can be born, all of us are born with some weakness in our flesh, some sin that would desire to dominate us more than other sins, or we deal with sins that others don't seem to deal with at all, but we must be on our guard related to our weak area all of the time. We're all in that category. The point that God makes as it relates to that, concerning homosexuality or any sin, is that he's greater than it. He's greater than it. And he comes into a life and he is able to do exceeding abundantly above all that anyone could ask or think by his Holy Spirit who will work within us. And so this is a dangerous scene. And you look, and sometimes I look at the United States of America and some of the steps that it's taken here recently. And sometimes I look at it and I figure, well, unless there is wholesale repentance, just the sowing and reaping process looks like it'll probably wipe us out, or at least end up humbling us in a big, big way. But the problem is, as it relates to Sodom and the sin of Sodom and this level of rebellion, is that God doesn't just let the sowing and reaping process carry itself out to its fullness. He enters in with judgment. And that's why it's very, very frightening for the unrepentant state of this nation and others. And then the men said to Lot, have you anyone else here? Son-in-law, your sons, your daughters, and whoever you have in the city, take them out of this place. Are you in Sodom tonight? Not just homosexuality, but any Sodom. Something where you've pitched your tent towards something and the fields, and you looked at it, and at one time it was green, it was a valley, it was well watered, it looked like it would be prosperous, and you've put yourself in the middle of it, and you've put yourself in the middle of the greatest wickedness. You never imagined what kind of wickedness was involved in it. And now you find yourself in the middle of that kind of a situation, and you know enough about God that He is going to come down on the scene, going to come down on the situation, and He's warning you to get out of the situation, get away from it. Well, listen to Him. Listen to the advice of the angels here where they said, take them out of this place, get out of this place, because we're going to destroy this place. Why? Because the outcry against them has grown great before the face of the Lord, and the Lord has sent us to destroy it. And even as Abraham interceded for Sodom, for it to be spared for 10 righteous, there was apparently some number of people who were praying that God would also deal with the situation. And He's going to answer their prayer also. And He's bringing justice into the scene. And does it mean that this group of people, however many there were, that looked and said, God, You've got to do something about this city. You've got to do something about how far-reaching is its influence. You've got to do something here concerning the vileness of its sin. A person that would pray something like that, are they a rotten person? No, I think all you have to do is become a parent to understand those prayers. Where you look and you say, Lord, for the sake of the next generation, for the sake of those who are unable to defend themselves, for the sake of the people who are victims everywhere of the influence of this kind of sin and other kind of sin, would You bring Your judgment on this and stop it, lest more be influenced with the same sin? And so that same intercession can go forward. And it can go forward out of a perfect motivation of love. And God's going to judge Sodom. And He's going to judge Sodom because it had sown within itself the seeds of its own destruction. It would have ended up destroying itself. Now it was just a matter of how many was it going to influence before it gets destroyed. And God comes in and says, I'm going to judge it lest its influence be any greater than it is, and any other victims be brought in under this kind of a person and this kind of perversion. And so Lot went out and he spoke to his sons-in-law who had married his daughters. Apparently they were betrothed. And he said to them, get up, get out of this place, for the Lord will destroy the city. But to his sons he seemed to be joking. And here he comes in and he begins to talk about God. Well, apparently this was a new subject. He begins to talk about righteousness, begins to talk about justice, begins to talk about all of this kind of stuff, and they crack up over it because they look at him again and they realize, who are you to speak about judgment? You have to be different from what you're going to speak against. You can't speak against what you're profiting from. You can't speak against what you are aligned with in order to make money and in order to have power and position and influence. And so here is a man who's not, as Jesus said, we need to be in the world but not of the world. Here's a man who is in the world and he is of the world. He is of this scene. They don't take him seriously. They don't take him seriously at all. It's the same way today. It's the same way today. And so they laugh at him. They thought he was joking. And when the morning dawned, the angels urged Lot to hurry, saying, arise, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be consumed in the punishment of the city. Get out of here. And while he lingered, and he's lingering, he doesn't want to leave. Why doesn't he want to leave? Because his treasure is in Sodom. His roots are deep in Sodom. And he is lingering there, and while he lingered, the men took hold of his hand, his wife's hand, and the hands of his two daughters, and the Lord being merciful to him, and they brought him out and set him outside of the city. Have you ever known a time, especially B.C., but perhaps even after becoming a Christian, when you were in the middle of a situation where it looked like it was going to come all down around your head and you turned around and somehow you got out of the situation? And you wonder, how in the world did I get out of that? I don't even know, but I got out of it. Well, we know why. Because of God's mercy, and because of His grace, and because He'll just take our hand and pull us out of situations if necessary. And so here he is, he takes just the mercy of God that got him out of there. And it came to pass when they had brought them outside that he said, escape for your life. Escape for your life. Anyone in Sodom, get escape for your life. Anyone in the worldly system, escape for your life. Judgment is coming. And it's coming upon the face of the entire earth. Run to Christ. Escape for your life, and don't look behind you or stay anywhere in the plain. Escape to the mountains lest you be destroyed. It's life, it's death, it's serious, it's big time serious. And then Lot said to them, and this is known as chutzpah, this is nerve. Please know, my lords, indeed now your servant has found favor in your sight, and you've increased your mercy which you have shown me by saving my life, but I cannot escape to the mountains lest some evil overtake me and I die. And see, now this city is near enough to flee to, and it's just a little one. Please let me escape there. Is it not a little one? And my soul will live. And he knows that destruction is going to come on Sodom and Gomorrah. And he says, well, here's a little city over here. Can I go over to the city instead of going way over to the mountains and everything? And then, you know, and you can spare the city because I'm there and there's just a few people there, so it won't really ruin things. And he said to him, see, I have favored you concerning this thing also, and that I will not overthrow this city for which you have spoken. Hurry, escape there, for I cannot do anything until you arrive there. And that's very, very interesting and an important point as it relates to theology for us as Christians. Because later on in 2 Peter, Peter uses this as an illustration that God is not going to judge the wicked and the just together. He won't judge them together. And even as he removed Lot out of that scene before he brought his judgment, so too will he remove us, the church, in the form of the rapture prior to pouring out his wrath in the great tribulation. And therefore the name of the city was called Zoar, and the sun had risen upon the earth when Lot entered Zoar. And then the Lord rained brimstone and fire on Sodom and Gomorrah from the Lord out of the heavens. And he overthrew those cities, all the plain, all the inhabitants of the cities, and what grew on the ground, wipes it all out. But his wife looked back behind him, and she became a pillar of salt. Isn't that interesting? My personal opinion is she looked back longingly, she delayed, and the judgment that came upon those cities caught up with her and overwhelmed her. But there's something about Lot's wife that Jesus wants us to remember. You remember, Jesus said, remember Lot's wife. And he said that in the context of end times. He said, remember Lot's wife. There's something that he wants us to remember every single time Lot's wife is mentioned. What does he want us to remember? She's a woman who turned back. She's a woman who turned back. But why did she turn back? Why did she turn back? Because her heart was in Sodom. Lot's wife is a very interesting woman. You can't look at her and say, well, this is a woman who didn't really understand the things of God. You can't really look at her and say that she wasn't a believer. You can't look at her and say that she didn't believe in the existence of God or that she didn't believe in the supernatural. Because here she is, she's fleeing the city, she's seeing the angels, she knows that judgment is coming, she sees the judgment, she sees all of this going on, she's heard the message of the angels, and she's even gone to the point of not only believing what they've said, but she's now obeying what they've said in fleeing out of the city. She was absolutely orthodox in everything she believed. She was right on in everything that she believed. The problem was not with her mind. The problem was with her heart. The problem was with her heart. Nearly saved. Totally lost. Because she had a mind for God, but she had a heart for Sodom. And I would not be able to put a number to how many people that characterizes. I don't know. I don't know. But Solomon wrote and he said, above all things, keep your heart. Keep your heart. Keep your heart undivided. Keep your heart free of Sodom. Keep your heart free of sin. Keep your heart free of the world and temptation and these things. He says, above all things, keep your heart. Why? Because a divided heart can overwhelm a mountain of intellectual knowledge. One of the fascinating things to walk as a Christian for any length of time is to watch people with incredible amounts of head knowledge. They know the Bible from Genesis to Revelation. They know all of the theologies of it. They know the intricacies of it. They know the Hebrew, the Greek. They know the types. They know the Bible like nobody knows the Bible. They have information in their head like nobody can believe. And they believe in the existence of God. They believe every word that God has said. They believe in miracles. They believe that judgment is coming. They even have begun to turn from that which is set aside to judgment and for judgment and turn and go in the right way. And it's amazing how a person can have that much knowledge. And then if their heart is even slightly divided, how a divided heart is able to win over all of that. You've seen it. You've experienced it. As we walk with Christ, the attempt of the heart to overwhelm what we know. We've got to be careful about our hearts. And that's the thing about Lot's wife. She was very orthodox. She knew an awful lot. That was not her problem. Her problem was a divided heart. And she looked back because of a divided heart. And so he warns us in the last days, in the context of the last days, Jesus reminds his disciples, remember Lot's wife. Nothing is worth turning back for. He told us, having put our hands to the plow, now let's not be found looking back. Very, very important. And she looked back, and she became a pillar of salt. And the interesting thing to me, and again, 27 verses 27 and 28 are so precious to me. Every time we come back to Abraham, what he's involved in the life that he's living in obedience to God is so appealing to us. And the interesting thing to me is he speaks here, and then he looked toward Sodom and Gomorrah and toward all the land of the plain, and he saw, and behold, the smoke of the land which went up like the smoke of a furnace. And here is Abraham, while here is, as you look at Lot, he is living a nightmare. You think about that. He loses his son-in-laws. He loses part of his family. He loses his wife. And he loses, by the way, every single thing he has. Every position he had, every possession he had, every title, every bit of money, every single thing that he compromised to gain, he lost. He lost it all. Every single bit of it. And while Lot is in the middle of this absolute nightmare, life could not get worse than what he was in the middle of. Over here is a life at the same time that was available to him a life of peace, a life of confidence, and a life of joy, and a life of fullness. It's a life of holiness. It's a life of being separated unto God and unto His Word and obedience to His Word. And in the midst of all of this madness that you and I see around us all day, every day, there is a refuge. There is a place. There is a place of fullness of joy. There is a place of refreshment. There is a place of communion with God. There is a place that's different. It's called holiness. It's called obedience to God's Word, being different from this world. So important for us to understand. So important for us to choose it tonight. Choose it tonight. Choose that life tonight. And it came to pass when God destroyed the cities of the plain that God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow when he overthrew the cities in which Lot had dwelt. And so, parents, relatives, whatever, keep on praying. Keep on praying. Keep on interceding for those that are even caught in Sodom's. Don't give up. Keep on praying. And then Lot went out of Zoar and dwelt in the mountains, and his two daughters were with him, for he was afraid to dwell in Zoar. And he and his two daughters dwelt in a cave. Apparently, I guess they might have felt like they were going to be blamed for what happened out there. They're the only ones that escaped it alive. And so they go off to live in a cave. And the firstborn said to the younger, "Our father is old, and there is no man on the earth to come into us, as is the custom of all of the earth. Come, let us make our father drink wine, and we'll lie with him, that we may preserve the lineage of our father." And drunkenness and immorality still walk hand in hand in our day. And so they made their father drink wine that night. And the firstborn went in and lay with her father. And he did not know when she lay down or when she arose. And it happened on the next day that the firstborn said to the younger, "Indeed, I lay with my father last night. Let us make him drink wine tonight also. And you go in and lie with him, that we may preserve the lineage of our father." And then they made their father drink wine that night also, and the younger arose and lay with him. And he did not know when she lay down or when she arose. Excuse me. And thus both the daughters of Lot were with child by their father. And the firstborn bore a son and called his name Moab, which means from the father. And he is the father of the Moabites to this day. And the younger, she bore a son and called his name Ben-Ammi, which is the father of the people of Ammon to this day, which means son of my people. And both of these groups were going to become premier enemies of the descendants of Abraham, of the Jews later on. And Lot drops off of the scene now in terms of a narrative of his life. He just drops off of the scene. Do we see how important it is in our lives to make right decisions? Here is a man who could have never dreamed, when he took and was given the opportunity to choose, he could have never dreamed where his choice would take him. And rather than seeking God and saying, "God, what do you have for me? You know my weaknesses. You know what your desires are for me," he chose on the basis of what would make him richest. And he is not alone. There are many Lots today. Choose what cities they'll live in. Choose what places they'll live in. Choose what jobs they'll take. All of these things solely based upon, is that the most money that a person can make, and no concern about their ability to stand or God's will for their life. And it's very dangerous. It's very common. Very, very common. And you look at a Lot, and to me, Lot speaks some very important lessons to each and every one of us, but especially to fathers and especially to husbands. And one of the things that Lot teaches us is that you never reach the world by being like the world. There's what is called the Hartford Declaration or Confession, and it says this: the church against the world, for the world. And the world won't understand that. The world won't understand that we stand against it, and it's not easy to stand against it and its ways. They don't understand that you can stand against it out of a motivation of stand against the world because we are for the world, the sense of wanting it saved. But I look at a lot, and as I look at him and his instruction to really us as men and as fathers and as husbands, it teaches me about the importance of the choices that I make. And it's so easy as a father to make choices and to forget that it impacts my whole family. It impacts my whole family. And I can take and look at a choice, I can take and look at a decision, I can look at a Sodom, and I can look at it and I can say, yeah, it's not the best thing, and I know it'll require compromise, but I'll just get in there, I'll just spend a little time in there, just make my money and then get out. And the funny thing is you never get in there and you don't get out. The great tendency of the lot is to look and to say, I can handle it, I can go in there, I can live in a Sodom, I can prosper in a Sodom. I can make money in a Sodom. I can handle their movies. I can handle their music. I can handle their input. I can handle all of that stuff and get out of Sodom alive. Maybe you can, but your family may not be able to. That's the tragedy for Lot. He could. He got out alive by the grace of God, but only two members of his family did. And then our decision-making processes, it is so important for us as men to take the whole family into account. What can they handle? What is right for them? And as I bring in, and we are inundated with that which is corrupt. There's a million magazines that are absolutely corrupt and ought to have no place in a Christian's life. A million movies. Million different kinds of things, and you can bring them into your house and you can sit down and you can watch them and you can say, well, you know, it was this and yeah, it wasn't so good about that and that wasn't so good about it and everything, you know, but it really didn't change me, and we don't realize how much it does change us, and we don't realize how it affects the kids and how it affects our wives and how it affects us too. And so here is a man who justified it and said, I can handle it. That's not the issue, whether you and I can handle it. We've been called as men to protect our families and to be a wall for them, a wall of separation, a wall of protection. That's what God has called us to. And we're told in 1 Peter, in what is a very gracious passage towards Lot, but it is the New Testament. It talks about that righteous man, Lot, whose spirit was vexed, his righteous spirit vexed or tortured in the city of Sodom. The interesting thing to me is I think if Lot could come back and preach to men's conferences or speak to anyone he could speak to, is he was a man who was vexed, but he was still unwilling to separate. He was vexed about the input into his family and into his home. He was vexed about all of the entertainment. He was vexed about the condition. He was vexed about the carnality. He was vexed about the lack of spirituality. He was vexed about how the world was conforming, even his family. He was vexed about all of it. Vexed very, very much, but he was in the middle of his torture, in the middle of his vexation. He was unwilling to separate. I won't change. Lot is the father of those whose righteous souls are vexed with the life that they're leading, the life that their family is leading, and they live this tortured, quiet life knowing that it's not the way that it's supposed to be. but they never make the stand. They never do what's necessary to make things the way that they ought to be. They just continue the vexation. And if that's you tonight, you are in such danger, but worse yet, your family is in such danger, where you're tormented. You know you're under conviction, and you realize what God has called you to and what you ought to be about, and you can't believe to what depths you've dropped and stand things you wouldn't have done 2 years ago or 6 months ago or allowed as it relates to your family and all. And everything comes tumbling down, all of it, but just willing to endure the vexation rather than changing. And I think if Lot were able to appear on the scene, he would say, do more than be vexed. Change. By the power of God Almighty, change. Make a stand. Do what's right. Cry out to God. Raise up the banner and the standard of holiness in the house. Protect the family. Be more than vexed. Do what's right. Sobering, sobering lessons of Lot. And we have to be very careful, because they know what appeals to our flesh, and there's gobs of it out there. But it is life and it is death. And Abraham journeyed from there to the south and dwelt between Kadesh and Shur and sojourned in Gerar. Now, he really isn't told to make this journey, and he's going to lead himself into temptation. We need to be careful in our daily prayers where we ask God not to lead us into temptation, but deliver us from evil, that when we ask him not to lead us into temptation, that we don't then in turn lead ourselves into temptation. Do you know, again, as we go back to something we've discussed earlier, do you know that you have weaknesses in your flesh? Oh, I hope you do. There are places that I just, for me, the uniqueness of who I am, what I'm about, what are the weak links in the chain of Damien Kyle, that I don't have any business being around. And you don't find me there. And it's not because I'm a man greater than other men. It's because I've lived a life of bondage to those things already. I love my freedom. I don't want them to take me captive again. And so we have to be careful not to lead ourselves into our own temptation. So if I'm an alcoholic, I don't go buy my newspaper in a bar. You've heard Gail Irwin talk about those chocolate-covered raisins. Now I'm just going to show you how far I've come. I'm going to buy my newspaper in a bar. I can't even read this newspaper now. I'll leave it in a bar. It's foolish. It's foolish, whatever the illustration might be for our lives. And he's going to lead himself into temptation, and he ought not to have done it. And he'll pay a price for it. And Abraham said of Sarah, his wife, she's my sister. And Abimelech, Philistine king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. Now, he did this 20 years ago. Hey, how'd it go last time? Abraham, you're going to find out that God is the same yesterday, today, and forever. It's still not a happening scene to lie. So he comes in now and brings forth this lie here, and the king, these kings were not much into adultery, but they were into multiple wives, and they would just take. But God came to Abimelech in a dream by night and said to him, "Hi, dead guy." That's about what he said to him. He said, "Indeed, you are a dead man, because of the woman whom you have taken, for she is a man's wife." Isn't it interesting? God does not need our lies. He does not want our lies. He does not use our lies. All lying ever does is create more trouble for him and surely more trouble for me. And Abraham is going to try and justify his lie in just a moment. And we're going to get through on time. We'll have you out for the fireworks in plenty of time. And he's going to try and justify his lie by taking and giving the entire genealogy as it relates to Sarah and everything. And we discover that actually she was his half-sister, so it was really only half a lie. So while God can't use my whole lie, somehow half lies are open game, and somehow he needs those. But he's going to teach Abraham that he doesn't need Abraham's whole lies or half-truths or white lies or white elephant lies or any kind of lie or exaggeration or anything. He doesn't need our lies. And he's also going to reveal why it is that he lied. And the reason that Abraham lied. Now, not all lies come out of this motivation, but a great many do. Some people lie just because that's just what they've always lied, and that's what they do. But his lying comes out of fear. He's afraid, and so he lies. And fear is the opposite of faith. And he lies because he loses his confidence in his God to protect him. And how often in our lives, when there is that tendency to lie, or to exaggerate, or to come in with what we would call a half lie, there is that fear in our heart that wants to drive us to it. And the solution to it is to realize how big God is, and that He doesn't need my lies. And it's a very easy tendency to fall into being a liar or exaggerating. And God doesn't want it, and all it does is create trouble. So the great lesson of this chapter, for any of us involved in lying, is a pattern. Here's just that God doesn't need it. He doesn't want anything to do with it. It just makes things worse. But Abimelech, in verse 4, had not come near to her, and he said, "Lord, will you slay a righteous nation also? You're going to kill me and everyone? Did he not say to me, 'She is my sister'? And she herself said, 'He is my brother. In the integrity of my heart, in innocence of my hands, I've done this. I'm innocent in this, God.'" It was their lies. And God said to him in a dream, "Yes, I know that you did this in the integrity of your heart, for I also withheld you, buddy, from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not let you touch her. And now, therefore, restore the man's wife, for he is a prophet, and he will pray for you, and you shall live. But you, if you do not restore her, know that you shall surely die, you and all who are yours." And so, needless to say, Abimelech rose early in the morning, called all his servants, and told all these things in their hearing, and the men were very afraid. And Abimelech called Abraham and said to him, "What have you done to us?" Now this is the second rebuke by a non-believer that he receives in his life here. "How have I offended you that you have brought on me and on my kingdom a great sin? How could you let me do this? I even consider that to be a great sin, Abraham, and you led me into this thing. You have done deeds to me that ought not to have been done." A very strong rebuke of this man of God. Very strong rebuke. And he needed it. He needed it. This is a weak area in his life. Isn't it interesting that he fails in the area of faith? The thing that he's known for. Our strength is often our weakness. When it's unguarded, I think it was Oswald Smith say that. Or Oswald somebody. Not the Oswald that... And Abimelech said to Abraham, "What did you have in view that you have done this thing?" And Abraham said, "Because I thought surely the fear of God is not in this place, and they will kill me on account of my wife." He lies out of fear. But indeed, she is truly my sister. You see, she's the daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother. And she became my wife. So she's kind of the cousin, and then they had, and then we had a step niece who came, and then, and all, and so you can see that really it was only half of a lie. And Abimelech, he's duly impressed. And it came to pass, when God caused me to wander from my father's house, that I said to her, "This is your kindness that you should do for me in every place, wherever we go, the great man of faith that I am, say of me, he is my brother." And I say, there isn't grace in the Old Testament. Oh, our lives are covered with grace. And then Abimelech took sheep, oxen, male and female servants, and gave them to Abraham, and he restored Sarah, his wife, to him. He said, this is a kind of a payment. I'm clean of what went on here. Here's the payment of all of this stuff. Again, how much do you think Abraham enjoyed those things? Every time he looked at those dumb animals, he reminded of his failure. And Abimelech said, "See, my land is before you. Dwell where it pleases you." And then to Sarah he said, "Behold, I have given your brother," "I've given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. Indeed, this vindicates you before all who are with you and before all others." And thus she was reproved. So he takes care of his offense against her. And so Abraham prayed to God, and God healed Abimelech, his wife, his maidservants, and then they bore children, for the Lord had closed up all of the wombs of the house of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. And so let's stop there tonight, and we'll pick it up in chapter 21 next week.